I am Daniel Lekiz.
And this is Mick, the Doctor of Digital.
And welcome to Music 101. Music 101, I guess, is created to empower music itself, a legendary icon in the music industry. Another week, another great episode. Mob Tops versus Teen Idols, the British Invasion, and how American artists revolutionized music, part two.
Yes, indeed. As we saw in part one, the British Invasion of 1964 didn't simply introduce new bands to American audiences. It fundamentally rewired the creative DNA of American pop and rock music. With the Beatles, Rolling Stones, and their compatriots storm the charts, they forced American artists to reconsider everything from instrumentation and songwriting to image and artistic ambition. In conclusion, this episode explores how established and emerging American musicians responded to this seismic shift, tracing the evolution of sounds, careers, and creative philosophies that would define the decade and beyond.
So, Mr. Mick, what is the big picture legacy of how American artists responded to the British invasion? Did they ultimately reclaim their own music?
The answer reveals so much about how art, culture, and natural identity interact. The British invasion forced American artists to evolve or become obsolete. Still, in doing so, it sparked an incredible period of creativity during which American musicians created new forms and established dominance in several genres by the end of the 1960s. Let's consider what American rock looked like by 1969-1970, just 5 or 6 years after the Beatles appeared on Ed Sullivan. The Woodstock Festival in August 1969 was dominated by American artists. Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, The Grateful Dead, Jefferson Airplane, Creedence Clearwater Revival, Santana, Sly and the Family Stone, and The Band, and Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young. British acts were present, but not dominant. Woodstock represented a specifically American countercultural moment when music that drew from American folk, blues, soul, and rock traditions. When Hendrix played that feedback-drenched Star-Spangled Banner, he was making a statement about America with American music, even if his technique had been honed in England. Creedence Clearwater Revival deserves special mention because they embodied so much of what American rock reclaimed. John Fogerty and CCNR created swamp rock that sounded like it came from Louisiana bayous, even though they were from El Cerrito, California. Songs like Fortunate Son and Proud Mary from 1969 were protest songs and celebrations of American working class culture that could never be mistaken for British music. Between 1968 and 1970, CCNR had more top 10 singles, but no number ones, than any other group except the Beatles. They proved that American rock, rooted in authentic American experiences and musical traditions, could dominate commercially. Garth Hudson, whom we lost last year, and The Band, with their landmark album Music from Big Pink and its follow-up, the self-titled The Band, created what critic Grile Marcus called old, weird America in sound. Songs like The Wait and The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down told American stories with musical arrangements that drew from country, folk, R&B, and gospel. Four-fifths of the band were actually Canadian, but they were making quintessentially American music, often about the Civil War and the American South. Bob Dylan recognized this. He collaborated with them extensively, and they backed him on his controversial electric tours. Sly and the Family Stone represented another uniquely American response, racial harmony and funk rock that couldn't have come from anywhere but America in the late 1960s. Dance to the Music from 1968 and Everyday People from 1969 celebrated American diversity and integration in explicitly musical terms. Black and white musicians, male and female singers, creating funk rock that was too soulful for rock radio and too rock for soul radio, but undeniably powerful and original. By the time of There's a Riot Going On, 1971, Sly was creating dark, complex funk that reflected the disillusionment of American culture in a way no British band could articulate. The singer-songwriter movement we discussed earlier also demonstrated American artistic maturity. When Carole King's Tapestry outsold every other album in 1971, when James Taylor was one of the biggest stars in music, when Joni Mitchell was being recognized as a major artist, These were all signs that American popular music had evolved beyond trying to imitate British bands and was creating its own artistic statements rooted in American traditions of folk storytelling and emotional directness. Even American AM radio pop evolved in interesting ways. The Carpenters, Siblings, and almost my neighbors from Downey, California, created lush, sophisticated pop music that was distinctly American in its clean-cut presentation and meticulous production. Songs like We've Only Just Begun and They Long to Be Close to You from 1970 showed that American pop could be commercially successful without adopting British sounds or attitudes. Karen Carpenter's voice and the duo's arrangements represented a sophisticated American pop tradition that ran parallel to rock. Looking at country rock, which emerged in the late 1960s, we see another uniquely American form. The Byrds album, Sweetheart of the Rodeo, featuring Gram Parsons, fused rock instrumentation with traditional country music. The Flying Burrito Brothers continued this fusion. And by the mid-1970s, the Eagles were creating country rock that became the best-selling American music of the decade. Songs like Take It Easy and Hotel California were utterly American in subject matter and sound. No British band could recreate American music. By the early 1970s, American rock had also developed regional scenes with distinct identities. Southern rock, exemplified by the Allman Brothers and Lynyrd Skynyrd's Freebird from 1973, created a genre that was explicitly about American Southern identity. Detroit rock, from the MC5 to Iggy and the Stooges to Bob Seger, had its own aggressive working-class sound. Los Angeles had a country rock and folk rock scene. San Francisco had psychedelia and jam bands. And New York had an art rock and proto-punk scene developing in the early 1970s. The American contribution to heavy music, which we discussed earlier, became increasingly important. By the mid-1970s, bands like Kiss, Aerosmith, and Ted Nugent were outselling most British hard rock acts in America. And American punk rock, which emerged in the 1970s, about the middle of the decade, with the Ramones and the New York scene, represented another distinctly American musical statement. Stripped down, aggressive, working-class rock that rejected both British progressive rock complexity and American album-oriented rock self-indulgence. What the British invasion ultimately did was wake American musicians from a complacency that had settled over early 1960s pop music. It forced American artists to be better songwriters, more authentic performers, and more ambitious in their artistic visions. But rather than permanently dominating American music, the British invasion sparked an American renaissance that saw American artists create new genres: singer-songwriter folk rock, southern rock, country rock, funk rock, garage rock, psychedelic rock, heavy blues rock, and more, that were rooted in American traditions and experiences. There's a beautiful irony in all of this. The British invasion bands were themselves inspired by American music: blues, rock and roll, R&B, folk. When they brought those influences back to America in new forms, they forced American musicians to reconnect with their own roots and push those traditions forward. The result was a decade of unprecedented creativity that produced albums, songs, and artists whose influence continues to shape popular music today. Think about contemporary artists and how they cite 1960s American musicians as influences. Jack White channels the blues rock of the Allman Brothers and the garage rock of the Sonics. Nora Jones traces her lineage to Carole King and Joni Mitchell. The Black Keys root their sound in heavy American blues rock. Jason Isbell and other Americana artists connect directly to the band and Creedence. The streaming era has also introduced younger audiences to this music. Fortunate Son has over 400 million streams on Spotify. The Sound of Silence has over 1 billion. And All Along the Watchtower, Hendrix's version, continues to be discovered by new generations. In conclusion, American artists didn't just respond to the British invasion, they internalized its lessons about artistic ambition and authenticity, then created forms of popular music that were so rooted in American experiences and traditions that they couldn't be replicated elsewhere, ultimately establishing American rock as the dominant force in popular music by the decade's end.
Well done, Mr. Meek. Very well said. We talk a lot about artists, but what about the people behind the scenes? How did American producers and recording engineers respond to what the Beatles and the other British bands were doing in this studio?
That's a crucial angle that often gets overlooked. The Beatles producer George Martin and the engineers at Abbey Road Studios were pushing recording technology in revolutionary ways. Backward tape loops, artificial double tracking, Verispeed recording, and creative microphone placement. American producers and engineers were absolutely paying attention, and they rose to the challenge with innovations that would define the sound of American rock. Phil Spector had actually pioneered the wall of sound production technique before the British invasion, but the competition pushed him to even greater extremes. His work on River Deep, Mountain High with Ike and Tina Turner in 1966 is considered the apotheosis of this approach, layer upon layer of instruments creating an overwhelming sonic architecture. While the song initially flopped in America, it was huge in Britain. It represented American production ambition, matching anything coming from London. Spector's influence on American rock production cannot be overstated. Brian Wilson studied his techniques obsessively. Speaking of Brian Wilson, his work on Pet Sounds represents the pinnacle of American studio innovation in the 1960s. Wilson collaborated with engineer Chuck Britson at American and Studios and Western Studios in Los Angeles, using unconventional instruments like harpsichord, accordion, electrotheremin, and bicycle bells to create textures that the Beatles themselves found inspiring. Paul McCartney has repeatedly said that Pet Sounds was the primary inspiration for Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Songs like God Only Knows and Wouldn't It Be Nice feature complex harmonic arrangements and instrumental layering that pushed American studios to compete with anything Abbey Road could produce. Wilson's masterpiece, the unreleased Smile Sessions from 1966 to 67, showed American studios attempting truly psychedelic production. Good Vibrations, which was released in 1966, was recorded in sections at four different studios with multiple engineers, then assembled like a musical jigsaw puzzle, a production technique that predated the Beatles' similar approach on later albums. The song cost $50,000 to produce, an astronomical sum at the time, showing the level of ambition American artists and producers were bringing to the studio. Tom Dowd at Atlantic Records was another American studio pioneer who responded to the British challenge. His work with Aretha Franklin, the Allman Brothers, and Cream, when they recorded in America, combined technical precision with an understanding of how to capture raw emotional power. The live recording of the Allman Brothers at Fillmore East in 1971 showcased Dowd's ability to capture extended improvisations with clarity and power, something that British engineers used to more controlled studio environments rarely attempted. His use of 8-track recording, an advancement from 4-track, allowed for more complex mixing and studio imaging. Muscle Shoals Sound Studio in Alabama became legendary for its production approach. The rhythm section there, known as the Swampers, backed artists like Aretha Franklin, Wilson Pickett, and the Rolling Stones, who recorded Brown Sugar and Wild Horses there in 1969. Producer Rick Hall and the Muscle Shoals musicians created a raw, soulful sound that British studios couldn't replicate. It was rooted in the southern soil and the musicians' deep understanding of blues and R&B. When the Rolling Stones came to Muscle Shoals, they were essentially seeking an authentic American sound that they couldn't create in London. In Memphis, Stax Records house engineer and producer, and later the team at Arden Studios, created production approaches that emphasized live performance capturing over studio manipulation. The Stax sound, heard on records by Otis Redding, Booker T and the MGs, Green Onions, and Sam and Dave, another singer who we lost last year, was about musicians playing together in real time, creating a cohesive groove. This was in many ways a response to increasingly complex British studio production. American studios asserting that creative performance captured well was superior to studio trickery. As we move into the early 1970s, American producers began emphasizing a different aesthetic from British producers. While British producers like George Martin and Glyn Johns favored clarity and definition, American producers increasingly embraced a warmer, more compressed sound that emphasized groove and feel. This difference would become even more pronounced in the 1970s with producers like Todd Rundgren, who produced records for the New York Dolls and later bands, creating a distinctive American production aesthetic that was raw and more immediate than the British approach. The split between East Coast and West Coast production styles also emerged during this period. West Coast studios like the Record Plant and Sound City became known for a laid-back, spacious sound that suited the California rock being produced there. Eagles, Fleetwood Mac, after they moved to California, and countless others. East Coast studios maintained a tighter, more aggressive sound that worked for harder edge rock and the emerging punk scene. In conclusion, American producers and engineers didn't just learn from British recording innovations. They developed distinctly American approaches to production and emphasized different values, from the raw authenticity of Muscle Shoals to Brian Wilson's symphonic ambitions to Atlantic's balance of technical precision and emotional power.
Indeed. So, Mr. Mac, we talk about, well, how about discussing the female artists like Janis Joplin, Grace Lake, Aretha Franklin, Joni Mitchell? Did the British invasion change opportunity for women in American rock music?
Yes, although it's a complex story with both progressive and regressive elements. Pre-British invasion, most successful female artists in popular music were vocalists interpreting material written by others. Think Brenda Lee, Connie Francis, or even early Diana Ross and the Supremes. The British invasion's emphasis on self-contained bands writing their own material initially seemed to make things worse for women, since rock bands were predominantly male spaces. But paradoxically, the British invasion also opened doors for women to emerge as complete artists, writers, performers, and bandleaders. Janis Joplin is perhaps the most dramatic example of this shift. She emerged from the San Francisco psychedelic scene, first with Big Brother and the Holding Company, then as a solo artist, bringing a raw, bluesy intensity that challenged everything about how female rock singers were supposed to sound. When she sang Piece of My Heart at Woodstock in 1969, or wailed through Ball and Chain at Monterey Pop Festival in 1967, she wasn't trying to be pretty or palatable. She was channeling Bessie Smith and Big Mama Thornton, claiming space for female aggression and sexuality in rock music. She couldn't have existed in the pre-British invasion pop landscape, but the new emphasis on American emotional expression and blues roots created a space for her power. Grace Slick brought a completely different energy to rock music. As the lead vocalist for Jefferson Airplane, she had a powerful operatic voice and wrote sophisticated literary songs. White Rabbit wasn't just a great psychedelic song, it was a showcase for a female vocalist commanding the stage with authority and intelligence. Her presence in Jefferson Airplane challenged the assumption that rock bands needed male frontmen. Slick also wrote Somebody to Love, which became the Airplane's biggest hit, proving that women could be commercially successful songwriters in rock. The shift in the late 1960s toward confessional singer-songwriters created unprecedented opportunities for women to control their own artistic narratives. Joni Mitchell's influence cannot be overstated here. She wasn't just a performer, she was a complete artist who wrote her own songs, designed her own album covers, and eventually produced her own records. Ladies of the Canyon and Blue established her as one of the most important artists in popular music, period. Not female artists, just artists. Songs like Woodstock, which Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young also covered, showed that her songwriting was influential beyond her own performances. Doors opened for artists like Carly Simon, whose You're So Vain was both commercially successful and lyrically bold, a woman calling out a self-absorbed man with wit and confidence. Laura Nyro deserves mention as an artist who influenced countless others despite never achieving massive commercial success herself. Her albums, Eli and the 13th Confession and New York Tandaberry, featured sophisticated compositions that drew from jazz, blues, gospel, and classical music. And with her, we've got a number of things that should be pointed out. Songs like Stone Soul Picnic became a hit for the Fifth Dimension, and When I Die, covered by Blood, Sweat, and Tears, showed that women could write complex, genre-crossing material that influenced the broader musical landscape. And with her, we have things like you could mention with the soul side. Aretha Franklin's move to Atlantic Records in 1967 and her transformation into the Queen of Soul represented a woman taking complete artistic control. While she'd been a gospel-influenced singer at Columbia Records, her Atlantic period saw her arranging her own songs, bringing her own ideas to the studio, and demanding respect as a complete artist. Her version of Otis Redding's Respect flipped the gender dynamics of the original, turning it into a feminist anthem that demanded recognition and dignity. When she performed at the funeral of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in 1968, or when she appeared at the Fillmore West, she was operating as an artist of historical importance. The all-female rock band Fanny, formed in Los Angeles in 1969, was a direct response to the British Invasion's band model. They played their own instruments, wrote their own songs, and produced hard rock that competed directly with male bands. While they never achieved massive commercial success, their very existence challenged assumptions about women's capability in rock music. David Bowie called them one of the most important rock groups of their time. Liner notes to Fanny's First Time in a Long Time, songs like Charity Ball from 1971, showed that they could rock as hard as any male band. Even in country rock, women were claiming new territory. Linda Ronstadt's powerful voice and her choice of material, she covered everyone from the Eagles to Motown, established her as one of the biggest stars of the 1970s. Her version of You're No Good hit number one in 1974, and her albums consistently outsold most male rock acts. She wasn't writing all her own material, but she was making artistic choices about arrangements and production that established her as a complete artist. The British band, the Rolling Stones' treatment of women in their often misogynistic lyrics, songs like Under My Thumb and Stupid Girl, actually galvanized some American women to respond with their own narratives. The emerging feminist movement of the late 1960s and early 1970s intersected with rock music in ways that gave female artists both motivation and audience for assertive, self-defined artistic statements. By the early 1970s, the landscape had unquestionably shifted. Women weren't just interpreters of other songs. They were writers, producers, band leaders, and complete artists whose work stood alongside and often surpassed that of their male contemporaries. The singer-songwriter movement in particular created space for female artists to tell their own stories in their own voices. In conclusion, while the British Invasion initially seemed to reinforce male dominance in rock music through the band model, it ultimately created conditions that allowed female American artists to emerge as complete autonomous creative forces.
Well said, Mr. Mack, and thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and wisdom to the world. And as we begin to wrap up, all these artistic changes must have required business industry changes too. So how did the American music business respond to adapt the British invasion?
That's a really insightful question, because the British invasion didn't just change music. It changed the entire business infrastructure of American popular music. The old Tin Pan Alley and Brill Building model, where professional songwriters wrote material and publishers shopped it to performers, suddenly looked obsolete when the Beatles proved that bands writing their own material should dominate commercially. Capitol Records in America had actually initially rejected the Beatles, which became one of the most legendary mistakes in music industry history. After Capitol passed, the Beatles' American rights went to small labels, VJ Records and Swan Records, before Capitol finally picked them up. The lesson was clear. Major labels needed A&R departments that could recognize and develop self-contained bands, not just find singers to interpret others' material. This led to a fundamental restructuring of how labels operated. Atlantic Records, under Ahmet Erdogan and Jerry Wexler, was particularly savvy in adapting. They'd already been working with R&B and soul artists who had strong artistic identities, so the shift to working with rock bands that controlled their own material wasn't as jarring. But they did expand their roster to include rock acts. By the late 1960s, Atlantic had signed Led Zeppelin, though they were British, Cream, also British, but doing sessions in America, and later the Allman Brothers Band. The label's willingness to give artists a creative freedom became a competitive advantage. The emergence of rock festivals, Monterey Pop 1967, Woodstock 1969, Altamont 1969, represented a new business model for live music. Instead of the old package tours where multiple acts played short sets in theaters, rock festivals presented multiple day events where bands played extended sets for massive audiences. Bill Graham, who operated the Fillmore venues in San Francisco and in New York, became one of the most important concert promoters in America. Understanding that the post-British invasion rock audience wanted immersive, event-based experiences rather than quick entertainment. The album format itself became economically central in ways it hadn't been before. Pre-British invasion, singles drove the business. Albums were often just collections of singles with filler tracks. But the Beatles' Rubber Soul, Revolver, and Sgt. Pepper established the album as a complete artistic statement, and American artists and labels followed suit. By the late 1960s, album sales were driving the industry more than singles. FM radio, which played album tracks rather than just singles, created a new promotional ecosystem that favored albums designed to be heard in their entirety. This album-oriented approach required different economics, longer recording times, more expensive studio sessions, and more complex production meant higher budgets, but successful albums could also sell for much longer periods than hit singles. This kind of longevity was unprecedented in the singles-driven pre-British invasion era. Artist contracts began changing too. Pre-British invasion, artists typically had little control over their material, their image, or their business decisions. But bands influenced by the Beatles model demanded more creative control. Creedence Clearwater Revival's John Fogerty famously had bitter disputes with Fantasy Records over ownership of his songs, battles that highlighted how old contract models were ill-suited to the new artist as auteur paradigm. These conflicts would eventually lead to more artist-friendly contracts in the 1970s, though many artists still got terrible deals. Publishing rights became increasingly valuable and contested. When artists wrote their own material, they could earn both recording royalties and publishing royalties. The business side of the industry was slow to adapt to artists as songwriters with legitimate claims to ownership. Management became more sophisticated, too. Brian Epstein's management of the Beatles created a template for managers as creative partners and business strategists. American managers like Albert Grossman, who managed Dylan, Peter Hall and Mary, and Janis Joplin, and David Geffen, who started as a manager before founding Asylum Records, understood that artist development in the post-British invasion era meant long-term career building, not just chasing hit singles. The role of independent labels and boutique labels expanded significantly. Elektra Records, which had been a folk label, signed The Doors and Love, becoming a major rock label. Warner Brothers, which had been known for pop vocalists like Frank Sinatra, aggressively signed rock acts. The idea that rock artists needed label environments that understood their artistic vision became accepted wisdom, leading to more sophisticated and specialized A&R and more diverse label rosters. Radio formats fractured in response to musical diversity. Top 40 AM radio continued playing singles, but the emergence of FM rock radio, particularly underground or progressive rock formats, created alternative promotional paths. A band like the Grateful Dead could succeed with minimal AM radio play by touring constantly and getting FM airplay. This fragmentation of the media landscape paralleled the fragmentation of American rock into multiple subgenres, each with its own audience and business ecosystem. Record stores became cultural spaces rather than just retail outlets. Stores that specialized in rock albums, carried imports, and employed knowledgeable staff became crucial to the industry. Tower Records, which started in Sacramento in 1960, but expanded dramatically after the British invasion, became an institution where music fans could discover new artists and deep catalogs. In my experience, Licorice Pizza became an important social browsing experience for my high school buddies and me. The first time I met Ian Hunter was at the Bellflower, California Licorice Pizza. And record stores began creating a different relationship between consumers and music than the old model of buying singles at department stores. The merchandising of rock culture also exploded. Concert t-shirts, posters, fan magazines, and other merchandise became revenue streams that hadn't existed in the early 1960s pop landscape. The counterculture commodified itself, creating contradictions that artists like Frank Zappa would satirize, but also profit from. In conclusion, the British invasion forced the American music industry to completely restructure itself around albums rather than singles, artist autonomy rather than label control, and long-term career development rather than quick hit production, creating the basic business model that would dominate rock music for the next several decades.
Mr. Mack, thank you so much for your knowledge and wisdom to the world. And Mop and Tops versus Teen Idols, the British invasion and how American artists revolutionized music deeper into a cultural collision. And it did not just reshape charts, it rewired the DNA of a modern music. So, Mr. Mike, would you like to plug in something?
Appreciate the opportunity. Write the book, Grow the Business. Connect with me on LinkedIn. G. Mick, the Doctor of Digital Smith, PhD. Listen to the Doctor of Digital podcast. And also pick up a couple volumes I have on Amazon. That's On Track, Ian Hunter, and Burning America. And if you love music, join True Fans.
Yes, people, I support Mr. Meg, the Dr. Digital, and of course, our other podcasts, Music 101, Love Letters, Sex 101, as well as Mental Health 101. So, Mr. Meg, thank you so much for your time.
Until next time, Deus Vult.
Money come, people. See you soon.